You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with the man who's always right, Daniel Freeb.
What? Where does this come from?
Well, the controversial Lance Armstrong, apparently.
You've got this from an untrustworthy source.
Yourself, Daniel. And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Lionel joining us remotely.
Not remotely. I'm not remotely joining you.
Where are you, Lionel?
I'm at home. I'm on a staycation at home. Somebody on our Facebook group suggested that in response to Geraint Thomas and Luke Rowe's podcast, What's Occurring, we should call this Watford's Occurring.
Well, Watford's Occurring at the weekend was a 4-0 defeat in the first game of the season?
Incorrect.
What was it? 3-0?
Move on.
5-0?
Yeah. Move on.
Okay, well, that's enough football. That's the football quota for this episode.
It's not, actually. No, it's not.
Oh, really? But, why?
Well, you'll find out in a minute.
Oh, God. Don't put people off. lots of cycling to talk about. You'll give us a news roundup in a minute, Lionel. We're also going to hear an interview with Teo Geoghegan-Hart in this episode, the Team Ineos rider, who apparently will be leading Team Ineos at the Vuelta a España. It's happening starting in a couple of weeks. So we'll hear from him. We'll also hear an excerpt from our new friend special, Lunch with Jonathan Voters, which is a very, very personal, intimate listen. So we'll hear a little bit from that later on. But Lionel, do you have a news roundup, please?
Indeed, Rich. Yeah. Well, in the first part, we'll talk about the European Road Race Championships. And in the second part of the podcast, we'll be talking about the Tour of Poland. So I'll wrap those two things up at the appropriate time. As you say, lots of racing going on, Richard. Although the Women's Tour of Scotland didn't quite get off to the planned start because stage one from Dundee to Dunfermline was cancelled because of extreme weather. Very high winds.
What was
your
comment about that a few minutes ago, Lionel?
They had very high winds and standing water on the course on stage one. Well, I just joked, Richard, with you, between friends, that Scotland was having its summer on stage one of the Women's Tour of Scotland, so the stage had to be cancelled. But, you know, that's just a little joke between us. It's not
details of our Scottish event in November coming later in the episode.
There'll be a mob waiting for me.
Rotten eggs are available.
Well, the race got underway the following day and Alison Jackson, a Canadian rider with the Tibco SVB team, won the sprint. But the overall honours went to Leah Thomas of the USA, who won the third stage in Edinburgh ahead of her teammate Elise Shabby to give Bigler Pro Cycling the overall honours. The Hipsters Grand Tour, the Tour of Portugal, was won by João Rodrigues, one of four W52 FC Porto riders in the top five. That's the final football reference. And as huge crowds watching some of the stages. And what, Daniel, you've already expressed an interest in going and covering the Tour of Portugal next year and daily coverage and kilometre zeros.
Well, I covered it. I went to the Tour of Portugal 10 years ago, the Volta a Portugal, and one of the highlights of my cycling summer is always, well, generally, watching my favourite rider internationally, Johnny Brandão. Who is, he's an icon in Portuguese cycling, completely unknown, I think, to most people. But he's one of the, I was thinking earlier, how many professional cyclists are almost universally known and recognised by only their first name? Are there any? I think Remco Evenepoel is probably on track for that. But
Lance,
the controversial. But Johnny Brandão is universally known in Portuguese cycling as just Johnny. And the one of the highlights of the cycling summer is hearing the FTP, Portuguese state television commentator, Marcos Chagas, I think his name is, just referred to Johnny. But Johnny is the Portuguese Pulador. He's finished second three times, I think, in the Volta a Portugal, and another couple of times in the top five. Never won it. Very sad.
Well, there we are. So next year you'll be at the Tour of Portugal to see him win it.
I want a friend special on Johnny. Just call it Johnny.
Johnny, of course, Johnny Hoogeland for a time was, I think, universally recognised as Johnny Hotpants, wasn't he? Some people name is Johnny Hot Pants. That's a style that's very much gone out in the last few years, hasn't it? That sort of hit the cycling shorts, the bib shorts hitched right up to you.
Tommy Vaucler as well.
Correct.
This news roundup is veering dangerously off-road here, but perhaps appropriately, because talking of off-road, Matthew van der Poel won his third Mountain Bike World Cup round of the season and his second in a row at Lenzerheide in Switzerland. He plans to ride the World Championships on the road in Yorkshire next month and will return to road racing at the Arctic Tour of Norway this week. It's another big week for racing on the road. The Tour of Utah is already underway. The Binkbank Tour is underway. The opening stage was won by the Irish champion Sam Bennett. And we've also got the Vuelta a Burgos and the Arctic Tour of Norway, as I mentioned. Then the Vuelta a España starts on the 24th of August. One man who won't be there is Domenico Pozzovivo. The Bahrain Merida rider was training for the Vuelta when he was hit by a car and has sustained a broken arm and broken leg. This happened to him 5 years ago, actually, shortly before the Vuelta. So, hopefully Pozzovivo will be on the mend soon. And as I said, the first part of the podcast, we'll talk a bit about the European Road Race Championships, which were in Alkmaar in the Netherlands, but a wrap-up of who won what is starting with the women's time trial. Ellen van Dijk won for the fourth year in a row. Van Dijk is in fact the only woman to have won the European Championships time trial since it started. This time she was 30 seconds faster than Germany's Lisa Klein. The men's time trial was won by Remco Evenepoel of Belgium, ahead of his De Koninck Quickstep teammate Casper Asgreen. The whole event kicked off with an interesting new format, the mixed team relay, which we'll see more of at the World Championships in Yorkshire next month. The Netherlands won it. In brief, six riders, three men and three women, take it in turns to ride. The distance for this event was 44.8 kilometres. I think it's a bit shorter at the Worlds. But the Netherlands featuring Bauke Mollema.
Who would have thought that the Netherlands would win that, eh?
Well, I mean, strength across the board, that's the key, isn't it? I suspect that may well have been the reason they won it, because the three...
I was being sarcastic, Lionel. I mean, that's got the Netherlands written all over it, hasn't it? You look at Dutch women's cycling and,
exactly.
Nobody will come close.
I don't Amy think Peters, as well. Flirty Mackay and Rihanna Marcus were the three women in the team. They were joined by Bauke Mollema, Ramon Sinkeldam and Koen Bouwman. So yeah, gold medal for the Netherlands. The Netherlands also won the women's road race. Amy Peters beat Elena Cecchini and Lisa Klein, who were silver and bronze. Britain's best finisher was Alice Barnes. She was in the next group and took fifth place. But the standout race in terms of the way it played out and the way it finished was the men's road race, which we will talk about in the next part. A few hours after we recorded this week's podcast, the funeral was held for Bjorg Lambrecht in his hometown in Belgium. The 22-year-old Lotto Soudal rider died after a crash during Stage 3 of the Tour of Poland last week. Late last week, Lotto Soudal's team doctor Martin Meerhager explained that Lambrecht died because a lacerated liver led to internal bleeding, which in turn caused a cardiac arrest. Lambrecht's coffin was carried by five of his Lotto Soudal teammates and former teammate André Greipel. The church was full of his friends and family, and hundreds of mourners gathered outside to watch the service on a big screen.
Fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thanks very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor. And if you want to have a look at some new Rafa products, check out their bags. A new range of bags just been released, bags that will attach to your bike or your person. Very nice indeed, rafa.cc. I was out on my bike yesterday actually, and bags that attach to the bike are becoming kind of increasingly popular and less cumbersome than they once were. So have a look at frame packs and so on at rafa.cc. I think I might ask for one myself at some point.
I spotted you out on your bike, or I saw that on Strava, and then I started looking for Napalm, because I know that Napalm is a frequent user of Strava these days, but I think he must be riding, running under a nom de plume, because there's been no... unless he's been quite sedentary over the last few months, which I don't think's the case.
No activity, Lionel?
No, my Strava is secret Strava.
Ah, okay. Is that to avoid Stravanoia?
Julien Alaphilippe is the Alaphilippe of the Chilterns.
I did go cycling yesterday, and that's on
secret
Strava.
Cycling?
Secret cycling yesterday, and secret running a couple of days ago. I might go running today.
Why do you keep it secret?
Good question.
I had this conversation with Ned Bolting during the Tour de France. I don't know.
Is he secret?
No, he doesn't use anything. He refuses to use Strava. I'm not even sure he's got a mobile phone, Ned. But I don't know. I use it as a log, really. I'm not that interested in looking at what other people do. But Napalm, I know you're very competitive. We talked about this, where you're checking up on, you're spying on all of your friends, all your acquaintances, seeing what they're doing, see how many watts they're producing, their VAM.
This is completely invented.
No, we did talk about this.
Maybe. I don't know why. Maybe I should come out from behind the...
start a campaign.
The curtain.
Let's start.
Bring Napalm out into the open.
Closet.
I think it's just secret.
Come out into
just,
the open, Lionel.
Just for embarrassment's sake,
smell the
really.
Fresh air. More on my bike ride later in the episode. But the European Championships you mentioned in the last part, Lionel, the men's race, I think you're going to tell us about that. It was a fantastically entertaining race. Before you do, it was won by Elia Viviani, almost a family double, because Elena Cecchini, his girlfriend, second in the women's race. But it was a very unusual and very entertaining race, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was held in Alkmaar in the Netherlands, and had a sort of a really attractive looking finishing circuit, didn't it, which went through the town, which looked lovely, and there were some sort of cobbled sections, although there was a sort of slightly lighter strip of cobbles on the edge of the road, which the riders mostly used. But it was interesting because the course probably would have demanded a bunch sprint, but I think if the whole bunch had arrived at that finishing circuit all together, it could have been quite tricky to negotiate. So it was almost a relief to see that it broke up, and the three that got away, Elia Viviani, Yves Lampaert and Pascal Ackermann, a very strong trio, and you would have thought it would be very close between Viviani and Ackermann, and Yves Lampaert pretty much he got rid of Ackermann. The interesting dynamic was that obviously Viviani and Lampaert are De Koninck Quick-Step teammates, but of course on this occasion riding for Italy and Belgium. But Lampert's move in the final kilometres distanced Ackermann, and then when it came down to the sprint, there was probably only going to be one winner, and that was Viviani. But it was a really interesting race. The chase behind was kind of... there weren't too many riders available to chase, not too many teams that had riders left to chase, and a thrilling run in. And the European Championships road race is an event that I suppose we're perhaps a little guilty of overlooking, but I think the last three editions have been really good to watch. The one that Christoph won, and then Matteo Trentin's win last year, and this year
it comes in quite a good spot in the calendar, so it's found a home, hasn't it, in the calendar. There's not an awful lot else on, and it had a really good field. It was an interesting race even before those three got away, because there was a split with Italy really well represented up front and Viviani there. The French and the Dutch were had Demar and obviously Dylan Groenewegen, who would have been hot favourites as well on that course, and they were left chasing. It was a really interesting how that unfolded, and to see sprinters like Ackermann and Viviani then go in the counter-attack, it's a testament to what they're capable of. We often sort of pigeonhole these guys, don't we, as just guys who we see in the last 200 metres of a race. And someone like Viviani especially, who's a very accomplished track rider as well, he's capable of far more than that, and it's great to see them sort of unleashed and racing in a completely different way.
The course was designed by Nicky Terpstra, was it not? Insert joke about it having been the only thing Nicky Terpstra has done this year, but it worked, didn't it?
Well, it did. Terpstra, of course, missed it because of the injury he suffered during the Tour de France, which I guess wasn't the plan. But yeah, it was a very good course, and it was it's good as well, I think, to see riders riding for the national teams outside of the World Championships, it does make the racing completely different. And there was a time when seeing two riders from the same trade team in the leading three, that would have been a highly suspicious kind of move. But there was no question at all of Lampert and Viviani combining, I don't think. I mean, okay, they got away together in the end, but they were very much racing for themselves and for their respective countries.
Could it have been different if Viviani was staying at the Koenig Quickstep next year?
I don't know. I mean, another guy who was up there was Sam Bennett, who you mentioned, Lionel, won the first stage of the Big Bank Tour yesterday in his Irish Champions jersey. And of course, had he won the European Championship, we wouldn't have seen the Irish Champions jersey. And I wonder how he would have felt about that, because he was desperate to win that Irish Championship. Viviani, now out of the Italian Champions jersey, he will wear the European Champions jersey for the next year.
Well, the other big winner was Remco Evenepoel, who won the time trial. And, he's in a rich vein of form, having won San Sebastian the previous weekend. The sky is the limit for him, only 19 years old and already European time trial champion. And, he's going to ride the World Championships in Yorkshire, we are led to believe, later on this year, and possibly the Olympic Games in Tokyo next year, but probably not the Tour de France just yet.
Well, no, I think it'll be another couple of years at least before we see him in a Grand Tour, as Jan-Peter de Vlieger told us last week. But yeah, we were denied your thoughts on Evenepoel last week, Lionel, with you boycotting the podcast last week. What did you make of his win at San Sebastian?
Incredibly impressive, really. That's not an easy race, is it? And the way that he got away and then stayed away on the run-in. It wasn't like they, it wasn't like they weren't chasing him. For a 19-year-old, I can't think of a better performance from somebody so young. And I sort of tweeted about this, because cross-generational comparisons are a little bit awkward, but Lance Armstrong's first race as a pro was the 1992 San Sebastian, and he finished last in that race, came back the following year and won it, of course. Now, Armstrong wasn't as young as Evenepoel is now, but
you're saying that. Saying that Evenepoel's going to go on and win 7 Tours de France?
No, because I wouldn't engage in that sort of speculation, Rich, as you know. But to just give some context to the victory, the field at San Sebastian is. On the one hand, you can say, well, Evenepoel's not ridden the Tour de France, so he's not fatigued. But it's against a field of a lot of riders who are, battle-hardened from having come through the Tour. And although they may feel kind of tired, they're strong, aren't they? We see the sorts of riders who are at the front year in, year out. And for him to win it in such a fashion was remarkable, really. And, back to my comparison with Armstrong. Yeah, the awkwardness of that comparison is, the eras are probably quite different. Armstrong would have been coming into a field where EPO was probably being used quite rampantly at that time. So, it's not a perfect comparison. But when can cross-generational comparisons be perfect? They can't, can they? But I think it does lend something to not just the physical, but also the sort of the mental strength that Evenepoel is already demonstrating. He's clearly made of pretty strong stuff.
One way in which Napalm, the current generation, at this moment in time, is differing from the generation of the 90s and Armstrong's generation is that, we've got this sort of wave of precociousness or precociousness, precocity, both.
Fine.
Probably mean different things. Which has been very much in our minds, I think, over the last few weeks, with Bernal winning the Tour. Poland was a great example. We'll talk about that in a minute, with Sivakov and then Jai Hindley as well, and another couple of under 23 riders in age at least, doing very well there. Napalm, you are fond of always telling us that there is always young talent coming through, and you know we shouldn't be surprised by this. We shouldn't get too excited. What's going on that's different at the moment? I've got a theory, but I'll tell you in a minute. I want to hear what you think first.
Well, are you trying to make me sound like I've got a watering can of cold water?
No, go on.
To dampen down the enthusiasm for these riders. I mean, I haven't, but I think there's a big difference between Evenepoel and Mathieu van der Poel, for example, or Wout van Aert. I mean, van der Poel is 5 years older than Evenepoel, and I think there's a huge difference between being 19 and being approaching your mid-20s. You know, cycling is quite an old man's game, isn't it? We do see riders still performing at a very high level in their mid-30s. Riders can win the Tour de France for the first time at or approaching the age of 30. That is no longer unusual. It's not a sport that really has rewarded youth at the very top level all that often. And yeah, this crop of riders, well, the names kind of trip off the tongue, don't they? But Van der Poel, Van Aert, Egan Bernal, of course, just won the Tour de France, Pogacar, Pavel Sivakov, Evenepoel. I just think Evenepoel's, the fact he's 19, I think that really is significant. 5 years is a half of some riders' elite level careers, isn't it? When you think about it, you know, a rider might come through at 23, 24 and be done at 33, 34. It's exceptional. Evenepoel is not quite in the same bracket as those guys. And to see him win San Sebastian the way he did I hesitate to say I've never seen anything like it. But I was sort of struggling to compute, really, the way, the clinical way and the powerful way that he won it. And we shouldn't maybe get too carried away and say he's going to win absolutely everything, because we have seen talent that hasn't sort of followed through, and it hasn't matured as the rider has matured. So, you know, everyone's different, aren't they? And you can't necessarily say that because he's sensational at 19, he's going to be sensational at 25.
It could be cycling's Freddy Adu. You know, Freddy Adu was buff.
Well, who knows? I mean... that's another football reference.
It is,
but
is,
I suppose,
I'm afraid.
Kind of appropriate, because Evenepoel, a talented footballer as well, could perhaps it as a footballer.
He could be to cycling what Daniel Freeb was to golf.
Well, exactly. My two theories. Well, one is a very obvious one, and maybe a slightly outdated one, because this has been happening for a while now. But in the 90s, and most people will have read all the books, the memoirs, in the age of rampant EPO abuse and rampant doping, there was a sort of 2 or 3 year initiation that riders went through before they were kind of broken in and offered the sort of rocket fuel, and consequently I think that was why they didn't tend to get results until they were sort of 23, 24, 25. And another thing, and I think the main difference with this generation, is that the transparency and the exchange of information, and I think with tools like Strava, Training Peaks and so forth and so on, young riders now, teenagers, know exactly what pros are doing, know how they're training, and they can mimic that. Because physiologically, there has never been a reason why guys of 19 shouldn't be able to compete with guys of 25, 26, but that was the case. Whereas now, I think, you know, they've pretty much got the same tools available to them, whereas the pro peloton used to be a kind of secret society of a different level of knowledge, a different level of, well, medical support, which is no longer the case. It's been democratized, really, and across all age bands.
That's interesting, and I think it might also have an impact on the longevity of careers as well, because I think also with the emphasis on nutrition and the knowledge that's out there about sports science and training, yeah, riders at 19, 20, 21, 22 can perform at a very, very high level, but whether they can sustain that and all the sacrifices that it entails over time is another question, perhaps.
Well, Rich, without going too deeply into this at the moment, the flip side to the availability of all this information, and also the ability of teams to know what their riders are are doing is, I think, well, we're seeing the results, or some of the results of that, with some of the riders that have burned out or decided to retire young in the last few years. And I've spoken to some of them, and one thing that does come up is this sense of constantly being scrutinized and watched, including by your team and their coaches. You can no longer get away with doing easy sessions or not training the way you should. I've spoken to one rider who likened it to living in East Germany and being watched by the Stasi. There's a question of privacy as well, but I think some riders find that hard to deal with. And then, you know, we talked earlier in the year, didn't we, about this phenomenon of Strava as well. It's very easy to feel as though you're not doing as much as other riders, and that creates a certain pressure, and it creates a sort of maybe a disillusionment in some guys.
Well, you've just explained to me why my Strava
yeah, exactly.
is secret, Daniel.
Theo Gegenhardt has a theory on this as well. We'll hear from him just now. But just to mention on Poland, he was fifth overall at the Tour of Poland. His teammate Pavel Sivakov won. But there was one stage in particular, stage six, which turned out to be the key stage, really. Won by Jonas Vingegaard of Jumbo Visma, with Sivakov second, Jai Hindley third. 2 22-year-olds and a 23-year-old there, with another 22-year-old, Sergio Higuita, fourth. And I noticed, well, Theo Gegenhardt's 24 was eighth, Chris Hamilton, another 24-year-old, ninth. So that was a stage in particular that really hammered home that sense of there being this young generation. And what was very striking and very poignant about that stage as well was that it was just a few days, of course, after the death of Bjørg Lambrecht, the 22-year-old from Lotto Soudal. And, you know, those guys in that front group knew him well and raced against him often. And Theo Gegenhardt didn't know him personally very well, but certainly knew of his abilities as a bike rider. And I spoke to Theo earlier this week about the Tour of Poland, about helping Sivakov to win there, and also about the experience of the peloton performing its tribute to Lambrecht a day after his death.
Well, Theo, I mean, first of all, the race, the Tour of Poland itself, another similar to the Tour of the Alps in a way. You and Pavel Sivakov really seemed to combine very well, and Sivakov obviously ended up winning the race. You look like you sort of quite enjoyed the game that you were playing to help him win. I mean, can you describe those last couple of stages in particular, and whether that was a surprise that he ended up winning the race, or whether you thought that was a realistic goal?
I mean, obviously it's always enjoyable with such a strong team. We had Swifty up the road in the final of Thursday's stage six, and I had super good legs, and I think there was definitely one of the more intense days of racing that I've done as a pro, actually. It was, for all manner of reasons, just a pretty tough day and a very solid start. And I guess we just had a great team, and everyone was riding well, and Pavel ended up getting in that move that he could sit across to Swifty, so it was just perfect, really. He kind of got the toe across there, and even though he got beaten for the stage by the young guy from Jumbo Visma, it was still, good situation for us, and then kind of all to play for the next day. And yeah, I did really enjoy the next day. I had really, really good legs, so I guess that always also makes it a bit easier. And a different situation from other races with good numbers and stuff, but it was a good race, definitely. And yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise, I would say.
Do you, we saw it at Tour of California as well last year, obviously Tour of the Alps this year. You have found yourself in these situations where you've been able to be a really strong, teammate to somebody. Do you enjoy finding yourself in that role?
Yeah, I think so. I do enjoy it. I think definitely, obviously, it's even more satisfying when you win. But when you do, I'd say the most satisfying stage of Poland for me was probably the day previously, Wednesday's stage, doing the lead out for Swifty, just because as a team we nailed it perfectly. And we didn't win, but I think the plan we'd made, we executed exactly as we'd kind of set out, which is not that often in cycling that you can walk away saying that you've done that. And for me personally, to be dropping a sprinter off with 150 metres to go is not something I do every day, so that was also a good sign of the legs and stuff. But yeah, I think still on Saturday there was a tinge of regret personally, because I knew I had the legs to win, and I knew that was the GC day done, because it's a bit confusing when the race doesn't end on a Sunday. Thursday it was, not Saturday. But yeah, there was a little tinge of regret, just because I knew that I had the legs to win. But then as soon as the next day we were virtual yellow, that all kind of changes, because then it's very much a case of, okay, looking at how can we win this, and it was pretty clear that we just had to keep it together and Pavel would win. So yeah, kind of it shifted there pretty quick, but it was a very enjoyable race, I have to say. It was a lot of fun with the group we had. Obviously it was still a very strange week with what happened a few stages prior, but yeah, the last 2 days or the last 3 days, it was from a performance perspective really, really good, I would say.
I was going to ask you about Bjørg Lambrecht. I mean, just an awful tragedy. What was it like being on the race, and in particular the day after his death, and this tribute that the peloton played? I mean, you know, what were the emotions like? How did you cope with that?
I think everyone copes with it in their own way, I guess, which kind of goes without saying, but it's still important to remember. For me personally, I'd raced against him for quite some years, didn't know him particularly well, but kind of well enough, as you know, most guys in the bunch. And yeah, he was a massive talent. He's one of, I think for me, the thing with him is one of those guys who, James Knox put it very well, I think, that he kind of says he's one of those guys where you almost could see people wanting to not like him, just because he's really excelling in every way. And I know a few of the guys younger than me had been racing against him for years, and often getting beaten or beating him and finding it hard to beat him because he was so quick, but also such a good climber, etc., etc. But for me, he's one of those guys you could really envisage racing against for years. I guess the strangest thing about it was just such a weird accident, really. It wasn't like a dangerous moment of the race, or it wasn't like you can look back and say there was a specific kind of cause or anything. So that's quite of a different thing maybe to process than some of the other accidents there's been perhaps in cycling, where it was, you know, like with a motorbike or a dodgy corner or some specific thing. With this, it was just such a freak accident that I think you process it quite differently. The kind of way that you perhaps rationalize it as another guy in the bunch, similar age, similar situation. For me anyway, I saw an article talking about deaths in the peloton and kind of running some statistics and stuff. And for me, it doesn't fit in the same category as a lot of the others, whether that's people with undiagnosed health issues that have caused them to crash, or kind of incidents with motorbikes or with the course, because this was completely different. So yeah, it was a strange one to process, and maybe still take some more time, because I think when you're there in the race, even with the neutral the next day, it was it's hard to describe, really, actually.
It was striking as well on the crucial day, really. The three guys in the break, two 22-year-olds and a 23-year-old, and we've seen, you know, 22-year-old Bernal win the Tour and Evenepoel win San Sebastian. Is there a real sense of a kind of new generation emerging? It seems to have accelerated this year. You know, guys that age just weren't winning races like this a few years ago. How do you explain that?
I don't know, to be honest. I guess I think there's some element of self-belief that anyone is given when one of their peers achieves something. So the only way I can potentially look at it would be, you know, if there's a guy that you've been racing all these years in juniors and under 23s, a lot of us have. I mean, someone like who springs to mind, Nathan Van Hooydonk. I first raced him when we were 15. And there was even a few other Belgians that I first raced them in my very first race abroad, just a small Kermesse in Belgium. They're now pros. So I guess if you've been racing slash beating slash competing with someone for so long and they achieve something, I think that immediately delivers a kind of feeling of possibility, and even so, just if it's someone a similar age. So perhaps that's it. I mean, I think you already saw it last year and the years before, really. I mean, for me, watching the Yateses, the way they moved into the pros, they kind of delivered pretty much from the off, was pretty interesting to see. And even last year, like Enric Mas's Grand Tour podium resonates. I mean, he was only 23, I think, when he was stood on the second step in Madrid last September. So I don't know if it's particularly this year or if it's just been slowly that cycling's evolving and younger guys are performing better and better, and also maybe getting more opportunities from their respective teams and a combination of things. I don't think there's one clear factor that shouts out to me anyway, but I guess the more guys do it, the more the everyone else kind of believes it's possible and strives for similar, I guess.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code Lionel.
SISCP25.
Didn't sound very robotic.
No, I'm feeling...
Can you do it in character, please?
No.
You're feeling silly sitting at home doing a robot character?
Yeah, very.
Well, I tell you what, I think I was fueled by Science and Sport yesterday. I can only think that I was fueled by Science and Sport because I can't have been fueled by all those meals and the odd alcoholic tipple at the Tour de France. After no activity pretty much for a month, apart from the odd folding bike rides.
Absolutely smashed.
120 kilometres I rode yesterday.
How quickly?
Not very quickly, but I rode out to Windsor with a couple of friends, and it was a meandering route out there and back, stopped for lunch in Windsor, and we didn't go to that cafe that has been in the news the last week for having the sorry, Daniel.
Stopped for lunch.
I stopped for lunch, but otherwise I was.
So what you're saying was that you went for lunch yesterday and you rode your bike there?
No, I did 120 kilometres. Come on, bit of respect for that.
Okay. And will this bike ride be featuring in Lionel's in Lunch with Lionel?
Might be part of the Explorer series, Lionel. What do you think?
I think you've got to do a bit more than that.
Well, I was with a guy who is riding from Land's End, John O'Groats, in a couple of weeks, and we are going to hear a little bit from him at some point, so watch this space.
Is this all training for our event in Yorkshire? The World,
really.
Championships?
How do you even do that? Stop for lunch and then in a bike ride? Did you leave it an hour afterwards before you set off again? No?
I mean, it was a very light lunch, Daniel. As I said, I was fueled by Science and Sports. I just needed a light lunch.
Tasting menu?
It's just a very light baked potato. Anyway, on with... We heard from Theo Gegenhart in the last part. We're going to hear from Theo again on the Vuelta later on, but... Lionel, it was interesting what he said. His theory about why we're seeing so many good performances from so many young riders at the moment.
Yeah, that stood out really, because you mentioned the Tour of Poland, and with Pavel Sivakov being 22 and Jai Hindley 23, the top 10 was packed with young riders. Sergio Higuita, 22 years old, riding with EF Education First. Teo's only 24, Latour 25, Hamilton 24, and James Knox, who was 10th, 23. And I think these summer stage races, the Tour of Poland, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent the Bink Bank Tour, they do offer riders, young riders, an opportunity, partly because perhaps they don't get selected for the Grand Tours or more than one Grand Tour per season. So a lot of young riders line up for the summer stage races, and the difference between just being on the start line and thinking, oh, this is a taste of some World Tour action, or a chance to kind of develop gradually, riders are seizing their opportunities, and partly that's down to their talent, but I think partly, as Theo Gegenhart was saying there, if they see their peers doing something, then they think, well, if he can do that, then I can match that or better that. And it's almost like they're kind of egging one another along and lifting the level up?
I think that's definitely true, Napalm. We see this emulation effect on national levels at times. We've seen it with a generation of French riders, young French riders. We see it in teams, you know, in any sort of given month or 2 months of the season, there'll be a team that starts winning and then starts really gathering momentum. But it's interesting, isn't it? You mentioned this kind of, well, this blossoming of all this young talent. But on the other hand, every year we still get to the Grand Tours, and in particular the Tour de France, we look down the start list and we talk about how risk averse the teams are in terms of fielding average or teams with an average age of 29 30 31 32, and they're still very loath to throw in first and even second year pros. And I wonder now whether that will start to change. Bernal was a bit of a trailblazer last year, wasn't he? But I wonder whether next year we'll see a couple more 21 22 year olds.
Do you not think that teams are risk averse because they're all risk averse, and then if somebody shows that perhaps something else can work, others will follow, and other teams who think they've got somebody that, well, maybe not as good as Bernal, but that maybe stopped thinking of age as being a barrier. I think if somebody is good enough, then they're old enough. I mean, that is a cliche that goes across sport, but I think that Bernal's been fairly sensibly and carefully handled, hasn't he? It's not like he's ridden three or four Grand Tours already to get to that point. It's almost like they've you know, open the box and let him prove what he can do. And you know,
and he was actually a bit of a sort of false neo-pro last year. Well, he wasn't a neo-pro, he'd already had two seasons, I think, with Gianni Savio, so he was, you know, he was relatively experienced.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
We're in danger of sort of glossing over Sivakov's win, you know, and on any other team, I think there'd be a rider. If you look at what he's done this year, Tour of the Alps, a top 10 finish at the Giro, and a win at the Tour of Poland, which is a big race with a quality field. On any other team, you'd be saying this guy is going to lead his team into a Grand Tour next year. And again, with the age factor perhaps not limiting his ambition, how are Ineos going to, you know, keep all these guys happy? Carapaz joining, Bernal there, Froome coming back at some point, Geraint Thomas, and Pavel Sivakov. It's quite a conundrum for them, isn't it?
Well, again, it's a nice problem to have, isn't it? To use another sporting cliche. I mean, much better to, as we've seen this year with Chris Froome missing the Tour de France, and then Team Ineos having multiple options and finishing first and second in the Tour de France. I mean, yeah, it's formidable, and balancing that talent will be a challenge. But in the end, it will come down to who is going best. You know, when the Giro comes around, and I suppose they'll set out at the start of the year a plan. They won't just leave it kind of like cats in a bag, all squabbling for supremacy, will they? They'll have a strategy, and they'll sell that strategy to the riders and turn it round so that the riders buy into that strategy and you know, a kind of convinced that it's their idea. I mean, that's how they've run from the start, isn't it? So I don't imagine it being a problem. But if you were, you know, Pavel Sivakov, looking at it, thinking, you know, automatic leadership rights for a Grand Tour, that can't really be taken for granted. It's something that's going to have to be earned in that team, at least.
Well, I asked Theo Gegenhart about this as well, and he is, according to our friend Ciro Scognamiglio at Gazzetta dello Sport, he will lead Team Ineos at the Vuelta. Geraint Thomas is not going to ride there, having that was a possibility. So, you know, if you look at the Grand Tour season this year, Team Ineos led by 22-year-old Sivakov at the Giro, by 22-year-old Bernal at the Tour de France, and by 24-year-old Theo Gegenhart at the Vuelta. Don't think we could have imagined that at the start of the year. I asked Theo about that and about his ambitions at the Vuelta as well. We'll hear more from him now. And speaking of opportunities, we read in Gazzetta that that you're going to lead Team Ineos at the Vuelta.
Speculation.
I'm sure you'll play a straight bat, and I remember before the Giro you were reluctant to confirm that you were even riding. Can you confirm that you're riding the Vuelta?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm aware and planning and all the rest of it, I'll definitely be there on the start line. I'd say it's pretty much been in my mind every day since I crashed out of the Giro, really. That left a pretty sour taste in my mouth that race, pretty much once we left Bologna and that prologue. It wasn't the best of 12-13 days for me after that, really. So it's definitely something that I wanted to amend very quickly, and that was part of what made Poland satisfying, really, was coming straight back in, high level World Tour race, lot of fresh guys there who've, you know, been preparing, training well through July and whatnot, and to perform directly after 2 months without racing was great. So yeah, hoping for more of the same in the next coming weeks, and there's definitely a lot of opportunities on the roads around Spain, well, so I want to make the most of them. Yeah. and end the season on a high, and also the Worlds kind of piggybacks onto that, so that they've both those races have been kind of completely in the headlights, as it were, for me personally since the Giro.
I mean, it's not, we hear that Geraint Thomas won't go to the Vuelta. There was talk of that, and you know, Sivakov led the team in the end at the Giro, Bernal at the Tour. It's not inconceivable that you could get your chance at the Vuelta. How would you feel about that if that opportunity was offered to you?
No, I think it's definitely possible and plausible. It's a great opportunity. I mean, I think I always kind of stand by the belief that to some degree, if it's more about the legs than anything. I think you can even say Egan showed that in the Tour. You know, he had the legs to win, and that was what he did, regardless of kind of, you know, the lay of the land, as it were. But yeah, it's just about making the most of it, and for me personally, it's about having a good Grand Tour experience, because last year in the Vuelta, I didn't perform as I'd hoped to coming into it, and then this year in the Giro, the it was kind of the opposite. The fitness and everything was amazing, and the opportunities were there, and just, yeah, just didn't go to plan, really, and the things that could go wrong did go wrong. So I guess kind of breaking it down in quite simple manners, it's just a case of racing each and every day with the 3 weeks in mind, but kind of just looking after myself and all these cliches of the, you know, the small things, and keeping an eye on the little details. I think over the course of like a week stage race, like in Poland last week, it's pretty relatively immaterial, but over the 3 weeks it's a whole nother ball game. So yeah, it's a big opportunity for me to kind of exploit that opportunity and make the most of it, which hopefully I can do.
Yeah, I mean, I heard in your excellent interview on don't like to call it a rival podcast, a complimentary podcast, the Mitch Docker one. You gave him a big interview before the Giro and talked about getting the training wrong for the Vuelta last year, really training too hard in the run-up. I guess that would have been a big learning experience. How are you preparing for the Vuelta this time around? Presumably, have you been at altitude before Poland, and what does the next couple of weeks hold before the race starts?
Yeah, definitely. I think last year was a case of my ambition and motivation being a hindrance, really, more than anything. Just doing too much and not having enough self-assurance and confidence, really, to back off when I needed to, and even to a degree, like just the inexperience of Grand Tour racing, because it's, you know, it's different to other races in the fact that you go in 3-4 days before and you have to do, you know, like a CADF blood test even 3 days before, getting woken up at 6 a.m. all these things like that, which I, you know, you just don't know about if you haven't done it. And I kind of made my plan that I was going to get down to Malaga or wherever it is where we started and kind of start my taper when I got there, more or less. And in hindsight, it just wasn't really possible to recover once I was in that environment with the extra heat and, you know, team training rides and all the rest of it. And probably the damage had already been done a few weeks prior, really, just from overdoing it in training and trying to squeeze in another block in the mountains and all these little things that now this year I kind of just decided to, it's a similar build up. I've got Poland and then about 10 days until I travel, but I'm much more self-assured, I guess, is the biggest thing, and just confident in where I am now and giving my body, if anything, a little bit of extra rest to start the race is, you know, really fresh. And I have to say, I guess each and everyone's different. The Giro this year, the first 10 days, we had a few days super hard, but then we also had 5 or 6 days unbelievably easy, like the easiest European road racing I've ever done. So the Vuelta last year was the opposite. It was, you know, a really hard first week with crazy temperatures, and this year again, summit finishes dotted through the first 7 or 8 stages and every day up and down tough roads. So it's all these kind of things that, you know, year on year you build up and you learn the approach that works for you. So I guess there's no major changes from last year. I think I'm still doing similar training and sessions, but perhaps the extra day here or there of recovery just makes that bit of difference, and the confidence that the legs are good from Poland kind of gives you that better holistic approach to it all, kind of stepping outside the bubble a little bit and just taking a moment to get some perspective.
I mean, you look at your team with Carapaz apparently on the way as well, and Sivakov is really putting his hand up, I guess, to maybe lead the team into a Grand Tour in the next couple of years. You've got the Tour de France winner, you've got Chris Froome coming back, you've got Geraint Thomas. Does that concern you at all, or do you still think that that's the best place for you to be in terms of your own development?
I mean, I just have to focus on myself in the end. I think it's easy to look around and there's a lot of big guys, but then at the same time, for all manner of different reasons this year, I've kind of come into the Giro with protected status, stuffed it up. My first race back, Poland, come into that with protected status. I was second in the Alps, won a few stages there, and, you know, could have well won the GC if it just played out slightly differently with which breakaway stuck on the decisive stage. So I guess there's always opportunities if you have the legs, as I was trying to kind of say earlier. I think it's easy to get caught up in focusing on other things, but for me, the concentration has to go into self-improvement, and actually I think that's something I've been fairly decent at the last years. It's not always linear, but I've kind of more or less managed to scrape out another 2 to 3-4% every year since I turned pro, and I think if I can just keep chipping away like that, not looking or trying to make any miracles happen, but just steadily progressing, then anything's possible, really. So the Vuelta is a good and next logical step in that, really, to now kind of apply the legs and level I've had in week-long stage races at point one HC and World Tour level to a Grand Tour. In terms of how it fits in the team, I think, I guess the Tour is always the big focus of the team and of a lot of riders. So if your ambitions can lie away from the Tour, which for now I don't have a massive problem with, then I think there's always ample opportunity to prove yourself. And in the end, look at a race like Poland, I would say with confidence the reason we won was because we had multiple very good cards to play as much as anything. So it can help you if you tactically use it in the right way.
Just finally, Teo, I mean, what was it like for you to watch the tour and watch somebody who you know really well and your sort of peer of Bernal win that? And also, have you seen him since he won the tour?
It was quite surreal, to be honest. I mean, I'd say I know Geraint fairly well, and okay, we're not from the same part of the UK or anything, but definitely gone through similar-ish career, kind of pre-world tour career in terms of through British cycling, riding the track, some of this type of stuff. So that was already, you know, really amazing last year. And then this year, yeah, it was just a bit surreal. I think for everyone, the tour was quite amazing to watch in terms of the first 2 weeks being so animated, and then obviously the final Alpine stages, kind of the script being completely ripped up from what was expected and how we thought it would pan out, and even the stages obviously not being run anything like what was predicted. So it was pretty amazing, and also, yeah, quite surreal, just you know, someone you know so well winning the world's biggest race. I don't think it was ever a case of if he would win it, but more when. But it's definitely earlier than I think most people expected. I haven't seen him since, but spoken quite a lot, and I think he's one of those people where I guess he takes things like that in his stride, the same as he's taken some of the tough moments with the collarbone pre-Giro, the really nasty facial injuries and crash that he had in San Sebastian last year, and the collarbone the previous year in Catalonia. He's had a lot of setbacks in his 2 years of pro, as well as, you know, these incredible wins, whether it's Paris-Nice, Swiss, or indeed the Tour. So yeah, knowing Egan like I do, I think he'll already be focused on his next race, and I have to say I'm happy to see him back home in Colombia and with his family and it's soaking up the moment, because I think even if he wins the race X amount of times more, the first time will always be something pretty unique. So yeah, I was happy that he's not kind of racing now or still, you know, away from home in Colombia, and yeah, I guess see him soon enough, probably after the Vuelta with the races in Italy or sometime after that.
Well, that was Teo Gegenhardt looking ahead to the Vuelta, and we're looking ahead to our own Grand Tour as well, aren't we, Lionel?
We are. Well, before that, we've got our event at the Royal Hall, Harrogate, during the World Championships on Friday, September the 27th. Still tickets available for that. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events, or just go to our website and click on the tab Live Events, and you can get links to all of where you can buy tickets to all of these events. So yeah, Harrogate in September, but then the Grand Tour kicks off in November, and between November the 11th and November the 30th, we will be in Bristol, Cardiff, Worcester, Belfast, London twice, two stages in London there. We'll be in Edinburgh. This is a new event. We'll be at the Churchill Theatre in Morningside Road on the 27th of November in Edinburgh. That's just been released, and tickets have been put on sale this week. We're also in Leicester.
Obviously, you're only going to go to Edinburgh if the weather's nice, aren't you, Lionel?
Stop it. You'll turn all the Scots against me again. Yeah, so Leicester and Manchester. And I think we've still got two dates to announce. They will hopefully be announced and tickets will be on sale very soon. But yeah, if you live in any of those places or near any of those places and you'd like to come and see us live, then go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on Live Events. And if you live in the vicinity of Worcester, because I think Worcester currently off to a bit of a slow start. Tickets out.
Belfast is almost sold out. I think Edinburgh's going very well indeed as well. But yeah, Worcester. Come on, Worcester.
Yeah.
Let's be having you.
Yeah, so this is our only series of events this year. Who knows what we'll do next year? I mean, goodness knows. What will we be doing next year?
Well, let's get this year out of the way first. But speaking of next year, Daniel, you were quite interested in some of the transfers already confirmed. And also in how maybe some teams have to look at you know, what they're doing and reboot almost. I mentioned Sam Bennett won this first stage of the Bank Tour. He's rumoured to be off to De Koon at Quickstep. He was actually asked about that in his post-stage interview. Quite an awkward moment, really, because normally those interviews are, you know, how does it feel to win? And he was kind of put on the spot about that. It was slightly a bit of a toe-curling exchange, really. He said there's quite a lot happening at the moment, but no comment. And he was asked a follow-up question. He said, nothing to say. It was a very, just on his sprint, I mean, he was a very physical sprint. Did you see it? It was a lot of headbutting, and he's become quite a formidable sprinter, but also competitor, Sam Bennett. You can sense his growing confidence, and I can imagine at a team like De Koon and Quickstep, he might be quite hard to beat there. But going back to transfers, that's one that's not been confirmed yet. A few have been confirmed, but, you know, what do you think some teams need to be doing in order to maybe just readjust their focus?
Well, Rich, I think what we said earlier about Ineos and Sivakov really underlines the fact that maybe, well, now it's a bit late, really, to start thinking about changing directions for next year for some teams. Because if, for example, a team was to be interested in signing a rider like Sivakov or a Theo Gegenhardt or a young rider like that, we're finding increasingly that they're tied up not to two-year deals, but often to three-year deals, and often well in advance as well. We're seeing contracts being renewed in the springtime or early in the spring. So, you know, that said, there are probably teams that have come out of the Tour de France thinking that they need to sort of maybe shift the paradigm, or sort of asking themselves big existential questions about what the team is and wants to be. I mean, you think of a team like AG2R, La Mondiale, who have really made no secret of the fact that they've built around Romain Bardet. Bardet won the King of the Mountains at the Tour de France, but did so in fairly sort of anticlimactic fashion. It was an anticlimactic competition, wasn't it? But, you know, that's a couple of years now that Bardet is flattered to deceive on general classification. What does a team like that do? Can they afford to have Bardet's Tour de France ambitions as their raison d'etre going forward? Another, just remaining in France with the French teams, another thing that caught my eye this week was Arnaud Démare saying before the European Championships that he sat out the Tour de France this year, and he's realised that he can no longer sit it out in future. He needs to be there. Well, Démare was disappointing in the European Championships, as he often has been in big one-day races, and after the Tour de France that Thibaut Pinot had, again, it's quite difficult to see how Groupama FDJ will justify giving Démare two or three riders and possibly taking away from Pinot's support. Could Démare do a role on the play a role on the flat? And we talked last week about the Thibaut Pinot documentary and how he was sort of let down on one stage in particular. Could Démare have been useful to him there? Possibly, but he's not going to have many chances, you wouldn't think, even if he did get picked for a Tour de France next year. So there are a lot of questions like this that the teams will be trying to address, but probably feeling as though, as I said, it's a bit late in the day to really decide they're going to change direction in 2020.
A few interesting moves among the sort of established or becoming established GC riders as well, isn't there? I mean, we've known about Vincenzo Nibali's move from Bahrain Merida to Trek Segafredo. That's been on the cards for a long time. We heard during the Tour de France that Mikko Landa would go from Movistar to Bahrain Merida. That's been confirmed. I looked absolutely delighted about that in the photograph that was put on social media announcing his move. He had his Mikko Landa face on for that. And Enric Mas going from De Koenig to Movistar, that's an interesting one. Obviously a big Spanish GC talent moving to Movistar. We're anticipating that Nairo Quintana's move away from Movistar will be confirmed anytime soon. But
the question is, who will Bahrain Merida sign to be just a tiny bit ahead of Mikel Landa in the GC pecking order?
Exactly, yeah. Poor old Landa. Yeah, they'll probably go out and sign somebody just that
little bit better than him.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's this kind of sort of conveyor belt of GC riders that have moved around. I mean, last year's one was Richie Port, you know, and the established GC riders there, that they have quite a long tail when it comes to, you know, how long they're considered to be desirable and worth the money. I mean, which is interesting considering the sort of the breadth of talent that is coming up behind them, and that may well be something that changes as time goes on. And you would think that riders like Sivakov and others, you know, would if they find it too stifling at Team Ineos, would certainly, you know, wouldn't have any trouble finding a home somewhere else. Another transfer that kind of caught my eye when it comes to Cofidis, and Daniel, you're talking about the French. Obviously, Viviani's going there and taking Fabio Sabatini with him, but they've also signed Guillaume Martin from Wanty Group Gobert. And you know, if you were Viviani, thinking, well, everything will be for me in the sprints at the Tour de France, then see that a sort of a second division GC rider is coming along as well. Again, you know, there's sort of quite a lot of jostling for position and so on going on at Cofidis next year, you would think.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, Martin has shown that he can achieve pretty good results without that much help at Wanty. I think he was 12th in the Tour this year. I don't think he's someone who thinks he's ever going to win the Tour de France. If he finished 8th or 9th and was prominent in a couple of mountain stages, that would be enough for him. So I think that should work out okay. I think it's a good sign, actually. I think you could probably make a case for Martin having been the best rider outside the World Tour for the last couple of years.
Yeah. Viviani might also fancy the Giro next year, with the Olympics likely to be in his schedule, I would imagine.
And well, CCC have done a bit of interesting business as well. Matteo Trentin from Mitchelton Scott, sort of an all-rounder who can do a bit of everything, as we've seen this season. Also a presence in the classics if all goes well. And Ilnur Zakarin as well from Katusha gives them a presence in the GC that they have not had this year, perhaps.
Yeah, you talk about teams looking for a raison d'etre. That's a team, CCC, with a Polish backer and in a sort of invidious position of having no big Polish rider, and there being two major names, Polish names, on other teams, Majka and Kwiatkowski. And I know that they've looked, as you would expect, at taking both of those riders, and they're not in a position to do that at the moment. Both of those riders are tied to other teams, so you know that leaves them in a tricky position. But I think Trentin is again, to use another cliche, a bit of a footballing cliche, he really would be the first name on the team sheet in most Grand Tour teams, not as a Grand Tour leader, but as someone who can do absolutely everything. He can support a leader, he can sprint in a bunch sprint even if you don't have a better option, and he can win in a breakaway, as we saw in the Tour de France. So I imagine they've probably paid quite a lot of money for him.
Another one that caught my eye, Davide Formolo to UAE Team Emirates from Bora Hansgrohe, Italian champion now, isn't he? So there are these...
Dan Martin?
Well, Dan Martin is an interesting one. He's at UAE at the moment.
I know he spoke to Ineos earlier in the year. I think he spoke to Israel Cycling Academy. There were rumours about him going to Direct Energy.
He'll definitely move, do you think?
I think, well, if Formula has gone to UAE, and looking at the other sort of talent they've assembled, that's a team that's pretty well covered in a lot of areas, hasn't necessarily performed that well this year, but I can definitely see Dan Martin leaving. I don't think he wasn't thrilled with everything this year, with equipment and so forth. So, they're two very different options, aren't they? Israel Cycling Academy and Sky, for example.
Ineos.
You would imagine Ineos, he could... find himself slotting into the same sort of groove that Kwiatkowski has, and as a sort of mountain, as a workhorse, really, and looking for opportunities in maybe 1 week stage races.
UAE have also signed Max Richese from De Koenig,
yes,
to help Gaviria in sprints. I guess he's also Argentinian and Pan American champion. It's amazing, isn't it? You know, another late summer where there's a bit of a brain drain from Patrick Lefebvre's team, and yet you can't imagine them being significantly weakened next year. You know, they lose Mass and Viviani, but you know, Evenepoel is coming along at a rate of knots.
Yeah, and I think also if they get Bennett, as I mentioned earlier, I think Bennett could be quite formidable in that setup. I just think he's a sort of coming man, and perhaps all he needs is a little bit more support, and he could be quite a hard man to beat. We should probably wrap things up for this week, shouldn't we, Lionel? But are we going to hear a little excerpt from your lunch with Jonathan Vauters, which you recorded during the Tour de France? It's an amazing listen, really, very, very personal. Vauters really opens up about, well, himself, really. We're used to talking to him about, you know, some of the business aspects of running a cycling team and, you know, things, topics that can be quite dry, but on which he tends to be very, very illuminating. But on himself, even more so. Let's hear an excerpt from your lunch with Jonathan Vauters now.
I always wanted it to be known that, you know, when it did all come out years later, that, you know, I wasn't hiding it from anyone. And people say, well, then why didn't you just blatantly come out? And the answer is a little bit similar to yours, not exactly. Like, at that point in time, you needed corroboration, and you certainly wouldn't have gotten corroboration from anyone else other than me. You know, the reason for that is that, unfortunately, in that period of time, anyone who I went to and said, you know, listen, I would like to discuss my doping, and I would like to discuss what I did, and I would like to put that out there as something to prevent young kids coming into the sport from making the same errors. But that's not an interesting story. The interesting story in 2005 was not that Jonathan Vauters had doped. That was sort of almost like irrelevant. Like, okay, here's this guy who is, you know, fairly good pro rider and now is running a little rinky-dink amateur team.
But you'd have been painted as the bad apple. You know, the bad apple theory would have come to the fore again. And would you have been able to say, well, yeah, but I was doing it, but Lance was doing it also?
Well, see, but this is it's, forget about being painted as a bad apple. I wasn't even worried about that. The follow-up question, if I come to you as a journalist and say, okay, I doped Lionel, your follow-up question has to be, did Lance Armstrong also dope? You were his teammate. And that's the interesting story. So actually, the next day, when the story's published, it has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with my story. It has nothing to do with me trying to make the sport a better place. But it's just a sensational explosion about Lance Armstrong. And as in the book, my book was never about Lance Armstrong. It's not about Lance Armstrong. Of course, like, newspapers and whatnot have picked up the little tidbits that are about him and created that as, like, the more explosive headline. So I just didn't want that. To me, it was like, well, this doesn't... It, you know, me doing a confessional, it's not about me. It's about whether Lance doped or not. And that... I really had no interest in that. My interest was trying to create some sort of momentum on a sport-wide basis. Because in 2005, 2004, you know, Lance Armstrong gets taken out. Well, whatever, you know, and you've got entire teams that are on massive internal doping programs at that point in time. So it's like, what's the... You're just cutting one part. You're cutting an arm off, but then the rest of it just keeps going. So it didn't make sense at that point in time, you know, to do that. Now, later, it did make sense because there were a broader group of people that were willing to be honest about, you know, the whole system, not just Lance. That made sense. And it's really unfortunate to this day that Lance at that moment did not choose to be sort of part of that, you know, just sort of drawing a line in the sand and saying, okay, this is what happened. This is the way it was. Let's move forward. That, you know, he fought it for a couple of years and then eventually came around to admitting it and so on and so forth, but never really taking responsibility.
That's Lunch with Jonathan Vauters, which is available to 2019 Friends of the Podcast any day now. I think may even be, as you're listening to this, it will be on our Friends of the Podcast 2019 feed. If you'd like to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. And I think that's Friends special number 10 for the year. It was a really interesting lunch and didn't go entirely to plan. We had hope to meet in London shortly before the Tour de France, but Jonathan's schedule got altered because I think his flight over from the US was cancelled. He was coming over to do some launch his memoir, which came out just before the Tour de France and which I read before the Tour de France, and in which he does open up a little bit about his personal life, which I'd not really sort of heard him talk about himself all that much before. So that was perhaps why the conversation went in the way it did. We booked a very, very nice restaurant in Castres for lunch on the first rest day of the tour, and when we arrived at 1:30, we were told that lunch had finished and that they couldn't accommodate us, which was slightly odd.
There's a shocker in France.
Lunch finishes at 1:30 in France. Amazing. So we
when does it start? 1:15.
I think it may well have done. It may well have done. It was a bit like that. They weren't budging, and so we had to sort of trudge round and find what was unfortunately a fairly bog standard brasserie where we had a fairly bog standard lunch. So the lunch itself was slightly disappointing, but the conversation certainly wasn't.
Conversation was sparkling. Well, you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Before we go, let's say a few thank yous to friends of the podcast. Thank you very much to, God, my eyesight's getting bad, James Graham, Anne Overton, Paul Wright, Vicky Chorman, Scott Michaels, Addie Nell, John Bentley, Christopher Day, Matthew Pavitt, and Chris Ditchfield.
Matthew Mihalta, Martin Fallon, Michael Eccles, Seamus Maloney, Benjamin Carter, Becky Olchin, James Horn, L. Gianotta, I'm going to guess that's Luca, I don't know why, it could be Lucia, could be Lorenzo, Jeremy Archer, no relation of Jeffrey, I presume, Paul Dickinson, and Pavel Tonko.
And a big thank you to Ian Slack, Chris Gresty, Sebastian Fisher, Jonathan Cave, Edward Austin, Matthew Slade, Emlyn Simpson, Andrew Woodside, and Andrew Riding.
Thank you very much to all of you, and thank you to you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, chaps. See you next week for our Vuelta preview, I guess.
Yep, can't wait.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.